history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that really ought to be told because it's important for the rest of us to hear them. I think you're going to enjoy the unique life story you hear from a 100-year-old veteran we have the privilege of meeting today. The idea here is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, we always come out ahead. We're educated, we're entertained, and often we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Our guest today is Marshall Soria of Fresno, California, who turned 100 years old on July 3rd. He was born in Mexico, raised in Wasco, California, and he's been through quite a bit in his life, including surviving the Battle of the Bulge with the 28th Infantry Division. We start, of course, with his childhood, and I always ask veterans how many siblings they had, but in Mr. Soria's case, there are multiple layers to that answer.
Two brothers and three sisters. See, what happened when we came in from Mexico in 1922, my mom had lost three girls and one boy to the epidemic in 1919.
The Spanish flu?
The Spanish flu. That's why I was born at 20. That's when they decided to come to the United States. So we came in 1922. June the 22nd, 1922, when I came over. Arvin and Bakersfield around there. Then we went to Wasco. My dad was working for the Hoover Farms. That President Hoover, he had a farm there, a fruit farm, and he was an irrigator for the fruit farm in Kern County.
So I'm clear. So your parents had four children that died in the Spanish flu epidemic?
Yeah, four that died.
Wow. You come to America as a two-year-old. What are your memories of growing up in Wasco? What was life like back then in the 1920s?
Well, it was all right until we hit that depression. That really hit everybody. And the wages was low and everything. Work was very scarce.
Well, for a big family like yours, that had to make things difficult. What do you remember about those years?
Well, I was still young because I started working when I was 10 years old, 10, 11 years old, to help out in the family because I was the older.
What kind of work did you do?
Well, help out here and there, water here, water plants, something that I could do, you know, after school. We started working in potatoes and all that. That's all it was, the field work. During the Depression, good thing my dad had a little job there, just working for that company. He had a steady job there, so that's what kept us, because a lot of boys weren't working at all. So that's what kept us going.
You know, that makes me wonder. I've had a few veterans over the years, when we talk about the greatest generation, your generation, I've had a few of them say, well, I think the greatest generation is my parents' generation because they know all the things that their parents went through. Did you ever get a sense for what it was like for your parents? I mean, losing their children in the pandemic and then going through the Depression.
Yeah, they coming through down here for the problem. They had to come in down here. Then they had to leave your children and go come and work for a while. See, my dad came before we did, and he worked in the railroad down here in Richmond and Fairfield. When he came over, my mom got to be a cook for that camp's boarding house for a guy that worked for the company, for the Giorgio. Uh-huh. He worked for that company. That was a big company. She was in the boarding house. She was getting good money. When we were going to school, at least we had a place to stay. My dad bought a little house in Moscow. But when the Depression hit, that Dust Bowl, Oklahoma, Arkansas, and all that, and that was something to see. I was about 12, 13 years old, but you could see when we went to Bakersfield, we used to see the kids that would come over with a tall truck full of their equipment, whatever they had, and the poor kids running around the fire without shoes in December. It was something to see. Then they got the WPA going, the CPA, and all the numbers that people start working, giving them work. That was
the government work programs?
Yeah. Oh, and the Roosevelt, of course.
And the guys were going to the CCC camps and all that, too.
Yeah, huh? I started going to CCC camps and all that stuff. I didn't qualify because CCC camp was the kind I was born in. I was an assistant.
Yeah, and I want to hear how that changed. I'm curious, too. And it sounds like, as what I'm hearing you, with regard to the Dust Bowl, it made an impression on you how bad off these people were, the kind of conditions they were dealing with?
Yeah. We were back on it, but they were worse. Because they didn't have a place that was just coming in. That's the way it was that time.
Do you remember having any ambitions, some dreams or hopes when you were a boy that you'd say, hey, when I grow up, here's what I'm going to do?
Well, they came after working in the field. After working in the field, nothing. Getting nothing for it? Cotton. Half a cent for a pound of you only could pick, a good picker only picked 500 pounds. The poor guys couldn't pick 100.
So you were picking cotton as a boy?
When we used to go out of school, we used to go in and pick cotton. And then the crooked guys come in there. There were a lot of crooked guys, and they still are. And he had a double scale. So he put his scale when the inspector was there. He took his scale off when the inspector was there. He said, oh, something wrong with my scale. I got to change that thing and put the good scale in. Boy, you go over there, you have 15 pounds. Maybe he was taking 2 or 3 pounds out of each time you went in there. Figure it out, and 15 times you go over there, you lost 15, 20 pounds. Mm-hmm. And paying the half, I said, what the heck? There were the guys getting rich. That the thing happened all the time.
So is that something that made you think, hey, I don't want to be doing this kind of work my whole life?
When I came out of school, I could go to school. My dad, that was the first thing my dad used to say, you better go to school. No, Dad, I don't need no more school. You know how a guy is when young.
Well, let's talk about school, because you were quite an athlete in high school at Wasco High. When did you realize that you were pretty good in running?
When we went to high school, because I went to high school, we came out of eighth grade, That's where I started running.
What was your signature event?
Well, the 3-3 was the best I got, because I put a record in and it's hold on for 30 years.
You had the record for 30 years in the 330-yard dash?
330 dash.
Uh-huh.
I went to West Coast Relays. I went to Bethesda Relays. And then when I was coached twice, it was a nice coach. After I got out of school, and I had a chance, but what the heck? The guy's young, you know.
So you could have run track in college?
Oh, yeah.
If you wanted to.
If I could have.
But you decided not to. But West Coast Relays and Modesto Relays, back then, those were really big events. People were coming from everywhere to compete in.
Yeah, that's why the Symphorini broke the record there in that year we came in there. From West Coast Relays. And Cornelius Wormwood then broke the pole vault record.
So is this 1938? Is that when that would have been?
Yeah. 1938.
Cornelius Warmerdam from Hanford.
Yeah, Mr. That guy from UCLA. Then I heard that he was blown up in an airplane over there.
Yeah, so Warmerdam did 15 feet on a bamboo pole.
Yeah.
But Louis Zamperini, who would run in the 1936 Olympics, had been competing for USC. He ends up going in the Army Air Corps. He's the subject of the book Unbroken. Yeah. And people have heard him here on this radio show on Hometown Heroes. So you saw those guys at the West Coast Relays.
Yeah, when they broke the record.
You ran on the same track that Zamperini ran on.
Yeah, same track. And there's a new stadium there. That was a new stadium then at that time.
That sounds like that was an exciting moment.
It was. It was. Never been out of that little town.
And your school, Wasco, won the small schools championship there?
Yeah.
So your father wanted you to go to college.
Oh, yeah. He wanted me to go to school.
And you said, no, I know better.
He always wanted me to go to college.
You decided to work in the fields instead?
Well, that's all we had.
Yep.
I didn't know what the hell was you turned to. Then we went to work, you had to turn your butt off, especially when you're thinning beets. You have to go in your back. You have to thin them four inches apart for miles. And they only pay you 69 cents an acre. You wouldn't even make an acre. And that was over. And then you had to plant the onions by with your finger. You had to carry a big bag of onions and just plant it up. Then I came to pick grapes in Delano. They have the farms. Sierra Vista has a farm, and the Japanese had their farms, and they all had their farms. But the Mexican guys had their own farm. Everybody had the same thing. They pay you every 15 days. You were 19, 20 years old. You wanted money in a weekend to go to the show, go nothing. You tell that guy, lend me some money. Had to wait 2 weeks. You got to wait 2 weeks. Well, I'll lend you some at 10% discount. And then they lend us the money, and they didn't give us no money. They gave us them coins. They were making all the money over there. They were making it over here. People didn't understand that dancing. Huh? Mm-hmm. When this Chavez came in, he didn't go after them guys. They went after the farmers.
Did you ever meet him?
No, I didn't meet him because the time he was there, he didn't work. About a year or so, he went to the Navy.
Yeah.
And then they took some company from Chicago came in and picked him up, teaching the ropes of unionizing and all that.
Yeah.
That's when he came back and started all this junk. But he went after the farmers.
Let me ask you about December 7th, 1941, because everybody seems to remember how they heard about Pearl Harbor. Do you remember how you found out what you were doing or where you were?
Well, I was in church. We were coming out of church.
Yeah, in Wasco?
Yeah. Coming out of church, there was a new stuff together, and all they bombed Pearl Harbor, bombed Pearl Harbor. And all the kids got excited. Some guys, well, I'm going to enlist. Rumors start going enlisting right away. Then the draft came in. The draft started coming in, and they started picking them. We used to know when we were going to school, we passed by the draft office. Some of the guys, there were no more guys. Where's so-and-so? Well, he's gone.
Mm-hmm.
This guy's gone. Where's so-and-so? Well, he's gone. They started going a little bit. When I went up, I was about the only guy that said, what the hell am I doing down here now? Well, my brother was only 19. He got called. He was winning 43.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, what the hell? I got married. I said, well, you know, I'm going to go enlist. Good thing I did this way. I got my citizenship papers.
Yeah.
And they carried me on through all of it. I went to the Army. Went to Camp Roberts. I stayed in Camp Roberts. That's a hot place, man. You think about hot. That's hot. We were in the East Garrison, and we had to go across the bridge and the other side every morning, hiking and all this. Hot or cold, every morning. Good thing we went in July. It was the 13th of July, I think, of 1944.
So something I want to make sure I clarify with you. You said your brother went in. He was 19, but he had been born here in the States.
Yeah, he was born here in the States. He was born after we got here in the States.
But you were born in Mexico.
I was born in Mexico.
So you still weren't a citizen.
No.
Is that one of the reasons you decided to join the Army?
Mostly it was when they deferred me, because they drafted me in 42 to go South Pacific. But they told me, turn me down. They said, no, you're not a citizen. We can accept you. Then they deferred me. They deferred me because I was working for this company, and I was their foreman and doing all the things that they were. That's a big farm. It was a nice one to go work for. It was a steady job and everything. But it got to the point, well, you have to work tomorrow. Well, I've been working all month long. I got to take a day off. Well, if you don't want me to turn you in. And I got tired of that. One day I told him, the hell with you guys. I'm going to turn myself off. Hey, you don't have to turn me. I'll turn myself in. That's the way I got out of there and went to the Army.
So I want to make sure again that I'm understanding it right. So when they drafted you, they didn't know that you weren't a citizen?
No, that's why they didn't accept me, because I was not a citizen.
But they did draft you? It wasn't you trying to enlist?
No, I was drafted.
Uh-huh. But then you told them I'm not a citizen? And
yeah, they find out right there.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, you're not a citizen. Uh-huh. So that's when they deferred me to the deferment for the... And then all the guys that were left, the 4Fs, you know, they were left. And when I seen all the guys, they're all gone. And right now, they're all dead.
Yeah.
So that's the reason I went enlisted. When we finished that training, we were going to go into the Pacific.
Hey, I have one more question about the deferment situation. Am I understanding correctly that you could have kept the deferment? You didn't have to go.
I didn't have to go, no.
You could have stayed there working,
yeah.
On the ranch?
Yeah.
So what was that motivation? What told you this is what I need to do at this point? Why did you join the Army?
Well, I can't be there all the time. I knew sometimes I got to get out of here.
Even though you'd be risking your life?
Yeah.
So you join the Army. You're training at Camp Roberts. You're thinking you're going to go to the Pacific. What changed? How'd you find out that's not what was happening?
We didn't find out until December. That's when we finished. That uh-huh. They gave us the clothes for the South Pacific, for Europe. They had khakis and we had the warm equipment.
So I got to ask you something else. Sorry, I know we're bouncing around here. Did you say you got married before that?
Yeah, we're in 43.
So you've been married for a year when you signed up for the Army?
Yeah.
How'd your wife feel about that?
She didn't like it.
I wouldn't either.
Well, the reason she didn't like it, because we had just lost the twins.
Mm.
We married in 23 and 44, and maybe she lost twins. Miscarriage. Everything's going wrong. Well, I said, maybe if I go, If I get killed, well, at least you get to get the
life insurance.
Insurance. Mm. You get your insurance. But it turned out all right. Even if we were going to, we had rough training, but good thing we did.
So you just told me, you know, you thought even if I get killed, then at least she'll have this money. So you were thinking, there's a chance I might not come back.
Oh yeah, we didn't. Because they used to tell when we were in the boat, they used to tell. They said, "You guys ain't coming." We didn't know that the bout was going on.
Mm-hmm.
It was starting when we were going over there. Because I took all my training in August, and it was August, not July, August, September, and October, and we finished in November the 16th when we graduated.
And he had no idea what he'd be facing over the next year. We'll find out from 100-year-old Marshall Soria when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I've found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myEECU.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 100-year-old Marshall Soria. He was initially denied the opportunity to serve in World War II because he'd been born in Mexico and was not a U.S. citizen. Later on, he gave up an agricultural deferment and went into the military as a pathway to citizenship. He would become a replacement with the 28th Infantry Division, which suffered extreme casualties in Europe. We'll hear about that, but we left off when he had finished his training at Camp Roberts on the Central California coast.
Then he gave us a furlough, but we had to report to Fort Meade, Maryland. And when we were over there in the loading up, you guys ain't coming back. That was the 16th when the ball started over. We went to Camp Chanks, New York, port of embarkation. When we got to port of embarkation, they sent us to New York one night because we had been guards one night, so they went and go. And we had the Queen Mary was there already. Oh, look at that boat, beautiful boat. Yeah, you guys going in it. This is waiting for you guys. So they start getting all the treasure. Man, oh, man. So we start loading. We left New Year's Day. You can hear the half of us crying hell. See the Statue of Liberty. Early in the morning, we were crawling out, leaving the Statue of Liberty behind.
That make you a little emotional?
Yeah, and it really makes you tears fall out. You could never come back no more. That's the way they went. So I think we were landing in Glasgow, Scotland. Because they said that we were about 15, 20,000 troops in there. They have to replace the whole. Everybody was slaughtered. Everybody lost all their men.
Yeah, this is already a couple weeks into the Battle of the Bulge.
Yeah,
so the losses are heavy.
A lot of guys lost a lot of men, 26, a lot of men.
Mm-hmm.
The 26 and 28 has lost the division, lost its colors.
Yeah.
Lost its colors. Lost all the men that paraded in Paris and all in August. They all got slaughtered there. They were in a picnic trying to go to a parade, because that was the parade division. They liked to parade and they liked to show off. So they went to Paris and thrown off, and the poor guys, they all got cooks and everything. They sent the cooks and gave them rifles. And when we got there, Glasgow, Scotland, then they shipped us right into the boat and to the trains, then they shipped us against to Southampton. I don't know if we were there a day or two. It was rapid. They loaded us in the LSDs, and we were ready for next morning to They jumped us in La Harve. They had the trains already. That's the 48th, the one that here in 509.
Yeah.
They were there ready. We were the first one to unload, last one to unload, and the first to unload, because we were the first one to get off. And half of them was crying, having, and first thing happened, never seen the snow before, and it starts snowing. Oh, my Lord. Starts snowing, and you had to load them cars.
And do you still only have warm weather clothing?
Yeah, well, we still had our khakis.
Because you were outfitted for the Pacific
yeah,
War.
We were up.
But now you're in the Battle of the Bulge and it's snowing.
It's snowing. Mm-hmm. Now, we went in there. Well, we were all right, because then this guy started coming in from, I don't know where the hell from, Tennessee. Everybody from everybody. You didn't know nobody in there. But we all got together. But some of us have already been out, seen the world. But some guys that haven't been out, young ones, hasn't been out. Oh, pity them guys. They start crying. I don't blame them. Crying for their mothers, crying for the. What could you do? You could do nothing.
And I'm just assuming, since at this time you're 24 years old,
yeah.
You're one of the older ones.
Yeah.
Most of these guys, the replacements
19,
are probably
19, 18, and yeah. 19. And they never had been out of their house before. So they didn't know what the world was.
So the snow hit you before the Germans hit you.
Yeah, that was the starting.
Uh-huh.
That was the starting. And then they loaded up the train. We pulled out. I don't know if it took us 2 days or 1 day, but they wrapped it. Because we stopped one place, and next morning when we stopped, we had lost two guys in there. They froze in the boxcars.
So before you've even had combat, two guys died from freezing
in the train.
Wow.
Because there were some guys that also, they haven't been in it, no. We have them Tennessee, Louisiana, all over the states we had them in there. Then we got there, 5-6 o'clock in the afternoon, because it was dark when they took us to the CP, where they started renewing the division.
Okay. And this is the 28th Infantry Division,
yeah,
Bloody Bucket Division.
So I got into the 110th, and the other guys got into the 10th, 12th, another division, because they were all messed up. They were all messed up. We lost our colors.
Explain to people what that means, for people that they've never been in war, they don't understand what you're saying.
The colors is the flag. Mm-hmm. The flag that we carry in combat. They ran over the plane and they took the flag. I think it was two sergeants left in that company. That's the guy that was taking us to the spots where we were supposed to be. Mm-hmm. But they didn't have nobody out there. They were empty. They start giving us spots. That night, when they call my name, go out. Somebody, a sergeant, I think somebody called, no, hold that guy. His papers had him come in. They wanted to make sure that my papers had come in. So I didn't go that night. Well, that night, next morning, when they take inventory, two or three guys were gone. That same night we came in there.
So that could have been you, had you not been held back.
My friend of mine that was with me, he went out that night. I didn't see him no more. If we met in the boat, we didn't see him no more.
He was killed?
Yeah.
What was his name?
I don't recall. We just met
on the boat.
In the boat. Mm. You meet a lot of guys in the boat, you don't need to know their name. Mm-hmm. Then next day, that's when they started, because we used to go in the night and start taking them. Okay, they would start setting them up again, put some more, replacing them, mm-hmm. replacing us. I said, here, you're going to get the BAR. Oh, my Lord. Hijo, mano. I said to him, well, what can you do?
Before that, you're just a regular rifleman.
Mm-hmm. He said, you're an automatic rifleman. 20 pounds, that darn thing, 21 pounds. Plus ammo, the magazines, 10 of them, they only weigh about 2 pounds a piece. You have to carry about at least 10 or 12 of the things. It all depends on how you use your gun. It's just like a machine gun. You just press that thing, the whole thing comes out.
So it's your first taste of combat. You're in the snow. You don't have clothes for the snow. Now you're carrying more weight with this BAR. And the BAR makes you a bigger target for the enemy, too.
That's right. I was a front man.
So you got a lot of things working against you.
Everything. I said, well, what the heck? I came over and listed, so what the hell? Who would have blamed me? I ain't got nobody to blame but myself.
And where were you guys?
In Bulge, in Belgium. Around there in Bastogne, $1,000 for me.
So how did that go, your first action as a BAR man?
Well, it was all right. We didn't have too much action for a couple of days. Then they start moving themselves here and there. When we got there, when we start going on open ground, it started going bad. You have to, your animal carrier has to be with you all the time, I see you. Then it started knowing. What was bothering me was my, I didn't have no overshoes, because they didn't fit. They were not overshoes for my size, so I had to wait, but you waited too long. Then your feet get wet. You take your socks off of them, clean them up, put them on, wash them, put them in your belt there, try to dry them up, mm-hmm. and change yourself again. You get your K-ration, get a little box like that. We didn't see a meal for January, February, I think until March. We see a meal.
Nothing but rations that whole
rations
time?
Rations, and yeah.
Can you describe for us how cold it was? And what that did to you, or how you tried to
Well, it was all right in Belgium, cold. But when they declared the war over, it was the 25th of January. They sent us farther north, or east, or no, we were sent us to the Alps. The Swiss Alps, because the French Alps, by Colmar. We had to go clean up a pocket over there, the Colmar pocket, they call it. That's where Audrey Murphy was coming with the 3rd Division. He was coming from the south, and we were in a mountain in LSC Mountains, and it got worse. Snowing, like it just snowed. Then it started freezing. Because when we climbed there, when they took us over there, we had to bypass to the back and climb to the back. We didn't go into the little town, it's a little village. We went to the back. We had to climb, had to use mules to keep the equipment up, the heavy equipment up. Mm-hmm. And we had to climb ourselves up there. Somebody must have been before, because the foxholes were already covered with snow. We just went in there and cleaned it up and slept in there. We're all bent up.
So you're sleeping in snowy foxholes?
Yeah. We have to go out. First thing we do, we go in there, the whole company gets in there, we all scattered out. Okay, first guard. You stay 2 hours on and 2 hours off. So you go out 2 hours, and you got to come and pick up the other guy. Because the two are together. So, okay, your turn. It was one night. It must have been the second or the third night we were there. We stayed in there. And one night, I looked at my watch, and it was about 2 o'clock in the morning. And my partner hadn't come in yet. He said, oh, something must have happened with this guy. So I went out and checked on him. He had his rifle. He had his rifle like that, and he was leaning against the tree, freezing. It was freezing. So I took him out of there, put him in there. So I put guard for 4 hours till the daybreak. So that was all right. But about 2 days later, they said, come on, I had the power. You guys go into the foxhole down there way in the bottom where the town is. They had a town. There was a big hole down there. He said, you go over there. You go stay guard over there, pull post until morning. I took 2 guys with me. We were 2 guys. My father. Then he paid for it. My feet started freezing about, it must have been 11 o'clock at night. This foot started getting itchy, 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 itchy. And it started going out this way. And then this other one started the same way.
So your feet are tingling and spasming?
Yeah, they were sticking this one the same way. Mm-hmm. It started the same way. What the hell going on? I told the guys, I said, I'm going to freeze, I can't. So I took myself, see what the hell was. Hell, I couldn't put them back on.
You took your shoes off, but your feet were so swollen, you couldn't get the shoes back on.
Then I had to put them on, but I cried, but I put them on. But the nets kept on going. And we could see the guys in there. Cause we could get up and look around. And see them guys about 3,000 yards away from us.
The Germans?
Yeah. They had their bonfires and they got that thing going, talking and everything. I don't know. I told them, I don't know if we're going to make it. And they said, well, we'll see. Wait a minute. Here was about 1 o'clock. It was getting worse. It was over here now. My whole body was getting out.
You're experiencing that frostbite feeling?
Yeah.
All over the place?
All the way down. It was coming up. Mm-hmm. It was coming up. So I said, if anything happens, you guys take off and I'll just stay here. How the hell are you guys going to carry me?
So you were afraid that you wouldn't even be able to move.
Yeah.
This is how bad this freezing sensation
was, is getting out. Mm-hmm. So by By 3 o'clock, I was checking the time. About by 3:30, I felt the thing was coming way over here now.
Up into your chest?
Yeah, up into the chest. I could feel like just the whole thing, the whole body thing was. And I told him, you know what? It's getting light when light. We didn't want to go too early because, you know, then you call you abandon your post.
Right.
You got a lot of rules. You had to wait. No matter what happens, you have to wait. So I waited. And then by 4 o'clock, 4:30, you know what? I think we better start going.
When the sun is just peeking over the horizon?
Just barely. Because I had to beat the thing. Cause I thought this was good. Get out of there before it, because it was in there. I had to get out of there. I came out. I barely came out of there. We had to climb the hill again. It was steep. It was steep, but good half mile. It was good half mile. And we knew where the teepee was, so they directed me right straight to the teepee. And honest to God, I don't know, the whole thing, all of a sudden, the whole thing shebang. Wah! I passed out. I think it froze out, everything. And those guys got hold of me and dragged me. They dragged me to the teepee.
So you're climbing the hill back to the command post, and this wasn't an enemy shell coming in or anything. You just, your body gave out on
yeah,
you.
Yeah, I gave up.
So
yeah.
you pass out?
Passed out.
And they drag you to the command post?
To the command post.
Uh-huh. So when did you come to?
That's when they started massaging me or something, because I don't remember. All I can remember, as they said, you want to be evacuated. And I told him, hell no. I just came in about a month ago. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be. So, I don't know. If the CP don't report to headquarters, there's nothing going about it. It's right there. They have to report it. I came through next morning. I was all right. Mm. I just thought that was all right. That was about the 1st of February by then. By then, they had already decided they were going to take Comar. I was able to go to Comar, walk into Comar. And took Comar. That's where I heard Adi was coming. That's where he got all his medals in there, in Comar.
Adi Murphy. A couple of questions come to mind. One, your feet. And you know, my grandfather was at the Bulge. He was a doctor, and he said he treated more frozen feet than any kind of wounds or injuries or anything. How bad did your feet get?
They didn't get affected.
They never
they
got
black. They were just frozen,
no.
Uh-huh. I think the ones that get my dad was the trench feet.
Yeah.
That's the water that gets into their feet.
Yeah.
It's the water, when they get the water, they get the trench feet.
And you avoided that by taking your socks off and putting them on your
That's
chest.
That's what we avoided when we were. Because a lot of guys left their socks on and just on and off and on and off. And they didn't take them off. We used to take them off and clean and wash them and just took them in here.
So you didn't have any lasting effects of that exposure?
No. Right. After that, it was all right. It still helps now, but I don't know what happened. Getting old now, I guess. But I didn't have nothing. But we took Omar. It wasn't over there, just the beginning. We've only been there a month.
And there was plenty more in store, just as there is in this program. Break time again. If you'd like to see photos of Marshall Soria then and now, you can head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll be right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today, Marshall Soria, just turned 100 years old. Maybe you're one of the nearly 2,000 people who mailed him well wishes for that milestone. Mr. Soria eventually became a cement mason. Candlestick Park in San Francisco was among the countless projects he worked on. He'd go on to have 8 children, 22 grandchildren, 40 great-grandchildren, and 26 great-great-grandchildren, and counting. But for all that to happen, he had to survive World War II in Europe as a BAR man with Company C, 110th Infantry Regiment of the 28th Infantry Division. What were your responsibilities as the man carrying that Browning automatic rifle?
Your responsibility to take care of the enemy. You got a rifle that shoots 20, but you shoot that thing, that thing's going to shoot 20 rifles at the same time. But that guy's only shoots one, then they have to shoot again. But now this going to and whatever you want to shoot. It just depends how you... You can run out of ammo if you want, but you run out of what the hell you'll do then. Because I told the sergeant, because, you know, we had a lot of boys there. They were afraid. I was afraid, but not as afraid as the poor kids were. And the sergeant, when you tell you, hey, you pick up so many guys, so to go with you in the patrol, and other, some guys are afraid. Mm-hmm. And when you get afraid, a person is afraid, it makes you bad for everybody. Puts you in danger. Being that I had to, everybody, you just say, hey, sorry, come over here.
You know, when you talked about being assigned the BAR, we had this thought of, well, that puts a bigger target on your back, too.
That's right.
Were there times where you experienced that, where fire was directed at you?
Yeah. Yeah.
Can you give me some examples or help us understand what that's like?
Like, for example, when we're in an open space, pushing through, and then your 88s are coming in, and you don't know where they're going to hit. But one thing they told us, keep moving. But some of the guys freeze. With that, it freezes you. Kind of, you keep on going, you used to say, don't stay there. If you stay there 1 or 2 seconds, that guy's going to take the second time. The first time I miss you, but he's not going to miss you the second time because they're aiming. But if you go forward, you're upsetting their range. The range is overtaking you, and you're ahead of the range.
Right.
And they have to adjust to their range. So that's a lot of things you have to learn in training.
But some guys would freeze up because they heard the shells coming
in? Yeah, yeah.
How close do you think stuff came to you?
Well, just like whipping in the machine gun. You're taking a machine gun they got in the 88. Mostly the machine gun. It's all right when you're down because they won't hit you very much when you're down because they up to a level that you can get away with it, but not, don't get, trust it too much. And then I used to tell the guys, keep on running stuff because then you see them fall. What the hell are you going to do? Keep on going. Mm. Nothing you can do.
That's got to be hard.
It is. And then when you see the guy fall, you don't know what to think. That's what God gets you afterwards. It gets you. Like when we were in Colma, when you go in there and then you see the guys with the triggers picking up the dead guys, like a wood. It's like a wood. Well, yeah, that was their job, picking up, cleaning up. Your body ain't worth nothing. That gets you in your mind.
That wears on you.
It gets you afterwards.
Because life was valued so little.
Yeah, that's right.
Did you get any letters from your wife while you were over there?
A couple, 2 or 3. She was mad.
She was mad that you left? Well, yeah. I'm sure there were nights where you wondered if you did the right thing, huh?
Sometimes you felt about it, yeah. Well, I said, it had to happen, What the heck? I made it through, God was good enough to bring me through. Then we started walking. When Colmar was secured, we started from Colmar to the Rhine. How far is it? From Colmar to Aachen, taking prisoners of war, cleaning up the towns. You go in there, clean it up, and keep on going. We put in 32 miles. They registered it was 32 miles in 2 days, full fuel pack.
With a BAR for you.
only God knows. That's why I say only God knows why he's got me here. I don't know.
How did you feel about the enemy?
Well, first it was bad because they had all old-timers. And then it was kids, 18, 19. You get them kids that didn't even know how to use a rifle. They start taking them prisoners of war. It was all right. I walked into Aachen. It's all right. I got a telegram that kid was born. I was in the Cologne River for the Remagen Bridge and the Cologne Church there right in front of
the cathedral that somehow stayed intact?
Intact, but they bombed it afterwards.
Well, I don't want you to gloss over that. So here you are. Your wife is mad at you because you leave her behind. You go off to war. You and your brother are both over there risking your lives. You've been through the Battle of the Bulge. You cleaned up the Colmar Pocket. And now you get to Aachen, which I'm sure is decimated. And you get a telegram that you're a father.
Yeah.
What goes through your mind in a situation like that when you get that news?
When I got that news, I told him, well, you know what to do? We'll just baptize him. And I don't know. I'm still going to make it. I don't know what's going to happen. Just baptize him. I don't think I'm going to make it because it looks like it's getting rough every day.
So you're questioning whether you're ever going to get to meet your son.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that way it was going. I said, well, it's pretty hard to say that you're going to make it when you're going through a lot of it. Could happen any minute. You go into the bunkers or go through the houses, cleaning up all that junk. You know who's in there, what they're going to shoot you with. Because they left behind a lot of guys just to hold you up. Mm-hmm. A lot of guys behind and just take care of them. You go in there, they could just, it could happen anytime. When we got to the Rhine, they put the Phantom Bridge right in front of Cologne. It was right in front of the cathedral. We stood guard for the guys to go. It took Patna about 6-7 days to pass. When they passed the Rhine, they went towards Czechoslovakia, and that's when they started spreading out. That's when they hit concentration camps.
Right.
Yeah. My brother went to Czechoslovakia. He was in the 26th and all. There were a lot of divisions.
Did you ever get any updates on how he was or what he was doing?
No. No. Well, after the war, he came over. See, he was in the bot right in the center of it. 26th got hit. 28th got hit. All the divisions. And they didn't take no credit for nothing. 101st got the credit for that.
Yeah.
But they hold him for so many days with the rifle and the machine guns and all they had. My brother said they ran. They were running all over scared, and all those guys were dressed in uniform. United States, speaking English.
The Germans were?
Mm-hmm. Right before the bombs, they slaughtered 40 or 50 guys. They just got the machine guns and took their uniforms off. Took their uniforms and gave them to them.
You talking about Malmedy?
Huh? Malmedy.
Uh-huh. Well, I don't want to miss the end there. So you get to the Rhine.
We helped them cross.
Yeah.
But we went straight through. We went to Germany, Berlin. We were about 20 kilometers from Berlin when they stopped us. Tanks and everything. They were waiting for Russia to get in there.
Yeah.
We could have gone in Berlin, but in the meantime, when we were going down, we were cleaning up this and that, rivers and all that thing. But it still was, I want to thank God for everything there. I can't forget that damn frozen thing. It's in my mind, been in my mind all the time.
Well, that would get me. When you guys heard Germany surrendered, VE Day. Was there some celebration at that news?
No, Eisenhower told us, when you get across the Rhine, I'll send you a bottle of champagne. And he did. You see that the bottle of champagne, a certain day, a certain hour, so everybody enjoy it together.
Uh-huh.
At a certain hour, a certain day, he sent the champagne to everybody in all of our companies, division, everything. And everybody, I don't remember what day it was.
How did that taste?
It was all right. He was all right.
I know this sounds like a silly question, but I think it helps us understand what you went through, what it was really like. Is there a moment that you look back from those months over there in combat that you say, hey, that was my closest call? That's where it could have been me?
Yeah. When I froze, because I was gone.
Yeah, you passed out. Huh?
I don't know how. If I would have waited 15, 20 minutes, I think it would have gotten that. I don't know.
If you would have stayed in the hole longer.
It's a thing longer.
Yeah.
Your heart can't take that much. I don't know. You would have frozen your heart or frozen something.
Your whole body was feeling frozen and you had a hard time moving.
Then when I passed out, I said, well, the poor kids. One was from Seattle, Washington, one from St. Paul, Minnesota. I can't forget them guys.
The guys who pulled you up the hill?
Yeah, I can't forget them guys.
Well, without them, your wife would have been a widow. Your son wouldn't have had a father. The rest of your kids and grandkids, great-grandkids wouldn't have been born.
Nobody would have been a problem there is now.
What was the hardest thing you had to deal with over there?
You don't know what the heck you were going into. I didn't know what the heck what I was going to go into. I didn't know nothing. What are you going to do? What am I going to go in there? Just going in there. I said, well, it's my turn now. What the heck? We're lucky I didn't go the first night, but it would have happened. But now, I look back, I've been going to France and seeing them kids thanking you for what you did.
Going back to France after the war.
Yeah.
And even the young people know you're one of the liberators.
Yeah.
Well, what was it like to come back, to the States?
Well, we just came back. Well, I'm going to see my family.
To meet your son for the first time, what was that like?
Oh, yeah, that was when I got home first time. Good thing was that the war was over when I was home, because we were the last guys to go in, and we already had lost points, and they were going by points. So they shipped into the 2nd Division. When they dissolved the 28th Division, the ship was back in July with intentions of having to go to Camp Shelby, Mississippi, and training for Japan. That's when I went home. They sent us home, and the atomic bomb was born. So when I went to back to Camp Shelby, they started dissolving the 28th, and they sent me to the 2nd Division.
Was it hard for you to transition back from being an Army man, and now you're a civilian again?
Yeah, it was hard. In other words, it's just you get a lot of thinking, start thinking a lot, especially at nighttime, especially when you get dizzy spells.
Does that still happen to you, or it stopped after a while?
It stopped. Took quite a while. I became an alcoholic.
Trying to drink that away?
I quit that thing in 53. Quit everything, because I was bad. I joined Alcoholics Anonymous, helped me a lot. I missed on the GI Bill with that drinking. In 50, I enlisted in Master of Mechanic and Aviation. I went there about 6 months in the GI Bill.
Uh-huh.
Master Mechanic Aviation. 28 months, you were a Master Mechanic. Then they were, at that time, the Air Force was just beginning.
Yeah.
But drinking went from Missoula, and I ended up in Cement Mason. I started as a laborer. I put in 20 years in with one company. Then I said, what the heck? I went to college and finished. Got me blueprint reading, estimating, and all that time they need for construction. I applied for my own license. Then I got my own license, and we went on our own.
And you know, I grew up a big San Francisco Giants fan, and I remember some of those cold, chilly nights at Candlestick Park. So I have you to blame for some of that?
No, we covered it up. It said they were going to clear, but then they cleared it up. We closed it.
Uh-huh.
The bus that would just be open, we closed it up. We closed it up.
You closed it up.
Yeah.
Did you ever think you were going to live to be 100?
Hell no. Not the way it was going. Not where I was going.
What do you give that credit to?
My good Lord, that's the only thing I can say. I was over about 98% gone. He didn't take me.
That night you were freezing?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's the closest I came. I didn't expect this kind of thing. That was all that Jenko went through.
I know it's been a few years now, but you got to go with Central Valley Honor Flight to Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
To see the World War II Memorial and a bunch of other cool stuff.
Yeah, it was nice. What I didn't like is all the stars that we lost, all the men that we lost. That's the saddest part of all the poor guys that got there.
Yeah, they've got 4,000 gold stars up there because that's 406,000 who died. What were you thinking about when you were looking at that?
Oh, you can imagine. I sacrificed myself. He went in that little bit and one of them. I thank God that, he had different ideas for me.
Amen. Apparently he still does.
With all the work we went through, I don't know how. I can't believe this.
So a few weeks ago, your family got the word out, hey, Dad's turning 100, send him a birthday card. So I think since then you've gotten a card or two.
1,000 or something. He's going to fill in.
You've gotten over 1,000 birthday cards.
Yes.
What does that mean to you, that people you know and also people that you don't know?
People that we know.
From all over the place?
All over.
How does that make you feel?
Wonderful.
So when you signed up for the Army, you weren't a citizen yet.
No.
When you came home from the war and saw your wife again and met your son for the first time, now you're a U.S. citizen?
Yeah. When they gave me the discharge, they gave me the citizenship.
What did that mean to you?
Oh, that's what I tell these guys. You go over there and go there. You're going to earn a citizenship. Go put your line ahead of line. Then you know you love your country.
What do you think the significance is of what you and 16 million Americans did in World War II? Why should it still matter to us today?
Well, those guys were in bad shape. France, Belgium, all those countries, Poland, they were all conquered. They're all conquered. They had to do what that guy said. Now they live in peace. If we hadn't wanted to come over there and liberate them guys, good thing we did.
So you got treated pretty well when you went back there,
yeah.
Huh?
You go over there, you get treated pretty well. In fact, if you wear that badge, you don't have to pay for nothing.
If there's anything else I didn't ask you about, feel free to share, but I want to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for sharing your story with us. Is there something that at 100 years old you would say that you're most proud of or most thankful for?
Oh, my family, they respect me. Thank God.
Anything else you want to say?
Thank you for everything you've done, and say hello. Say thank you to all the guys that sent me the mail.
There you have it. If you're one of the many who sent Marshall Soria birthday wishes for hitting the century mark, consider yourself thanked. You'll find photos and a short video with Mr. Soria online at hometownheroesradio.com or on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And I hope you'll join us again next time when we're reminded again through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.